It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up after 5:30, we'll look at how the Pulitzer Prize, which was yesterday awarded for reporting on the NSA's surveillance program, may influence public perception of both the NSA and whistleblower Edward Snowden. But first, it's been 1 year since three people were killed and more than 260 injured in the Boston Marathon bombing.
On this anniversary, we ask whether the United States is better equipped to respond to, if not prevent, domestic terrorism and why it happens in the first place.
Brian Jenkins is with us. He's senior advisor to the RAND Corporation president and author of No Path to Glory, Deterring Homegrown Terrorism. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, a year after the Boston Marathon bombings, what can we confidently say we learned from the experience in the way of deterring domestic terrorism?
Well, you know, we look at every single plot that's uncovered or attack that occurs to see what we can distill in terms of how we handled intelligence, how we handled the aftermath of the incident. Could it have been prevented? Could the response have been better? We have learned a number of lessons. The Inspector General's report from the Department of Justice was critical of the initial investigation and interview of the elder Sarnib brother, which had been motivated by the lead provided by the Russian authorities, although the IG report does not claim that the act could have been prevented, but they were critical. There was also criticism that the FBI, after it had conducted the interview, did not share any of the information with the Boston police. This is still an area which is difficult to deal with. It's not just a matter of sharing information, but there are some genuine concerns about privacy and civil liberties. Insofar as the response generally is regarded as having been handled extremely well. And one extraordinary thing that comes out of it is the degree of public engagement after the bombing occurred by the people of Boston in sharing their video material and quickly identifying the perpetrators, going along with a controversial lockdown, and indeed providing the tip that led ultimately to the apprehension of the second brother.
Mm. Did we learn more about why the threat of this attack and the lead up to the execution of it fell through the cracks in terms of the federal and local intelligence that might have been able to catch it ahead of time?
Well, you know, look, the record of domestic intelligence thus far has been remarkable. There have been, since 9/11, 43 homegrown terrorist plots motivated by jihadist ideology in this country. Of those 43 plots, the authorities have uncovered and thwarted 39 of them. Of the remaining four, three resulted in fatalities: the shooting in Fort Hood, a shooting in Little Rock, Arkansas, and the Boston bombing. Now, unfortunately, 20 people still died as a result of these attacks, and those are 20 tragedies. But a record of uncovering 39 potential attacks out of a total of 43 is an enviable record. No one believes that we're going to get it right every single time.
And terrorism tactics continue to evolve with time. They get more cunning, more sly, more innovative. How does that affect the way in which one can outsmart the terrorists, for lack of a better phrase? Do you have any insight as to how law enforcement and the FBI and other agencies try to stay on the cutting edge?
Well, first of all, the problem hasn't been that the terrorist plots that we've seen and even the attacks have been carried out by cunning and technically sophisticated people. Most of the attacks have been very amateurish. That is not to say that they have not been, on occasion, lethal. But it's not a matter of the skills of the terrorists. It's something else. 68% of these plots that have been uncovered involved a single individual. The remaining plots were tiny conspiracies. In the case of the Boston bombing, two brothers. There's no underground army of sleepers to penetrate. There's no terrorist group with an ongoing campaign to penetrate. These are one-off attacks, mostly by individuals or, in other cases, by tiny conspiracies. That's a real challenge for intelligence. We don't have X-rays for a man's soul. We don't have the kind of secret intelligence apparatus that can that is so omnipresent and so omniscient that we can pick up every single one of these attacks. So that's the real challenge here.
Right, and if you ask someone on the street, describe a terrorist for me, you know, who do you picture? You might hear a lot of stereotypical descriptions, jihadists, Muslims, that sort of thing. How accurate is that, though?
Well, first of all, the domestic terrorist threat in the United States is more diverse than simply those motivated by Al-Qaeda or other jihadist ideologies. In fact, individuals who were motivated by white supremacism or other hateful ideologies on the extreme right have been responsible for over 30 deaths in the same period of time that I spoke about the 20 deaths caused by the jihadists. So, in fact, some of these other sources have been deadlier. We still do have some occasional actions or plots by anarchist terrorists in this country. As I say, we have those on the extreme right and those motivated by Al-Qaeda's ideology. They account for the bulk of the threat. Insofar as our profile of a typical terrorist, if we put aside, you know, the members of the Ku Klux Klan or white supremacist groups, if we look at the jihadists for a moment, in terms of income level, in terms of educational level, they are not there that different from the profile of other males in the same age bracket. That is, if we compare them to similar age males in terms of the level of college education, level of income, we find a fairly diverse population. Some are high school dropouts. Some have postgraduate degrees. Some of them are really in the lower economic levels in terms of earnings. Others, in fact, economically were doing quite well. So there's not a... It's not as if that they are all wearing the same clothes, or that they're all from the, you know, theoretically oppressed. In fact, even when we begin to look at motives, we find that, to be sure, ideology, religious faith in the case of the jihadists, plays a role. But the most critical factor seems to be personal crisis. And in that sense, some of these ideologies merely have become conveyors for individual discontents.
It's interesting to me that you single out, or you make the distinction that these people are men. I know you're not a sociologist, but could you just break that down just a little bit and tell me whether, you know, law enforcement individuals or other resources in our society have latched onto that and are trying to address it?
Well, in terms of the groups that represent a potential terrorist threat right now, the fact is that they are overwhelmingly male. If we look at the jihadists who have been arrested since 9/11, there are a handful of women in that, either arrested for having knowledge which they did not share with the federal authorities, or misleading a federal authorities in the course of an investigation. In some cases, involved in propaganda or material support activities, but at least among the jihadists, the perpetrators have been almost exclusively male. On the other end of when we look at some of these extreme right-wing groups, there again we see that at least among the perpetrators that have been identified, an overwhelmingly male population. It was different in the 1970s and 1980s when in some of the far left-wing groups like the Weather Underground or some of the others where women played a more prominent role, but I'm afraid the jihadists and the white supremacists tend to be male chauvinists.
Mm. We're talking with Brian Jenkins of the RAND Corporation about the threat of domestic terrorism on this one-year anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombings. We hope you'll join the conversation. Do you believe that domestic terrorism is still a real threat today? Do you feel any safer on account of some of the lessons we might have learned from previous attacks here in the U.S.? You can let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. We're talking with Brian Jenkins on this one-year anniversary of the bombings at the Boston Marathon. Brian's the author of No Path to Glory, Deterring Homegrown Terrorism. And you're welcome to join the conversation as well. What concerns you most about the threat of domestic terrorism today? Do you feel safer or not since the attacks in Boston a year ago? You can let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, or you can also comment on the Central Time Facebook page. Brian, one element of, public discourse that usually is born out of these attacks and milestones in our history, especially 9/11 and starting after 9/11, is the issue of civil liberties and personal privacy and that sort of thing. And yet, what stands out to me about the Boston attack was that one crucial element in identifying the attackers was the use of public video surveillance cameras that were, I believe they were part of the city of Boston's street surveillance system. And did that stand out to you? And do you see a year later maybe more acceptance, more understanding of the use of these systems and a willingness to sacrifice personal privacy?
Well, let's make a distinction for a moment between the cameras, which have become a standard feature in a lot of public places, and other concerns about privacy. The fact is that there is a question, a legitimate question, as to what are the expectations of privacy in a public place. Lawyers argue about this, but the fact is we certainly have seen, not just since Boston, but as a long-term trend, the proliferation of closed-circuit television cameras. And these have proved to be valuable in dealing with both ordinary crime and more rarely in dealing with cases of terrorism. They are less a deterrent, it appears, but are more valuable in providing information that can lead to the apprehension of individuals. And that has some utility because we know, for example, in the case of the Boston bombers, that they were, had they not been apprehended, they would have gone on to continue their campaign. They already had bombs constructed to do so. So the intervention by the authorities, which was enabled by the footage from these cameras, did provide a valuable result. We've also seen, because of technological developments, the proliferation of cameras in the hands of every individual who has a cell phone, and we're looking ahead to devices that will be deployed, which will provide extraordinary powers through these so-called glasses that one can wear, and really raise new questions about privacy. So all of these are being debated. At the same time, there is a very serious debate going on about some of the programs that were being carried out by the government involving the monitoring of metadata from phone calls and internet traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And this has raised some real issues, and it is important to address these. Overall, I think it would be incorrect to say that civil liberties have been savaged since 9/11. I don't think that's the case. But as a consequence of new legislation, new laws, new programs, new assertions of executive authority in the federal government, we have put into place really the foundation for a much more oppressive state. We could, if sufficiently frightened, or if there was a less benign leadership in Washington, very quickly alter the relationship between government and the people. And in that sense, we're dancing on the edge of tyranny here.
I wanted to bring up the Harvard report. I don't know if you're familiar with that came out earlier this month, looking back at how the response of the multiple agencies came together. According to this report, this bomb response exposed, quote, fault lines in policing. That is to say that the communications systems, sort of, there was no coordinated system in terms of communication and resting. There were a lot of overtired officers, and there's an allegation that at least one officer might have been shot by another accidentally, although it's never been formally corroborated. What takeaways should we hold as a result of some of these things that happened in Boston last year?
In terms of the response, overall, one would have to say that the coordination of responses has become much better in recent years, in the years since 9/11, where we've been devoting more attention to this, as a consequence not simply of terrorism, but of some of these terrible shooting events that we have seen take place in various parts of the nation. Each of these incidents has called for a coordinated response by the emergency responders, by the police, in some cases from several jurisdictions. And so we've gotten better at that, unfortunately, as a result of a lot of practice. Is this still a work in progress? Are there still shortcomings? I don't know, honestly, that I have seen a single after-action report that did not point to problems in communication between police and emergency responders, or between various police departments in a multi-jurisdiction case. That just seems to be one of these chronic problems that we deal with, and apparently it's somewhat complicated. If it weren't so doggone complicated, I think they would have fixed it by now. So communications are a chronic problem. We just had a report recently that looked at a shooting at the Los Angeles airport. And there again, issues of communications came to the top in terms of one of the problems. With regard to tired policemen,
Brian, I'll jump in just for a moment here and say you've got 30 seconds.
All right. You know, again, chronic policemen, that's that again, in these long episodes, that can always be a problem. We don't have a solution to that.
Yeah. Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Brian Jenkins, senior advisor to the RAND Corporation president and author of No Path to Glory, Deterring Homegrown Terrorism, talking with us about the current threat of domestic terrorism today.
Coming up, the Pulitzer Prize was awarded to the Washington Post and the Guardian yesterday for their coverage of the NSA surveillance program. How will the prize affect public perception of the NSA and whistleblower Edward Snowden?